News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we head to the shopping mall with urban geographer, retail anthropologist, and entrepreneur Paco Underhill. His latest book is Call of the Mall. Paco Underhill spends a lot of time in malls. He's interested in how we shop. His business is called EnviroCell. Underhill describes its mission at the outset of Call of the Mall. Our specialty is looking at the interaction between people and products and people and spaces. We look at all the ways in which retailers, product manufacturers, bankers, restaurateurs, and commercial and other public spaces either meet or fail to meet their customers' needs. Today we'll get his thoughts on how the mall and the businesses within it meet or fail to meet our needs. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Paco Underhill. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In addition to Call of the Mall, Paco Underhill is the author of Why We Buy, The Science of Shopping. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Paco Underhill, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very good. And you?
Oh, I'm staggering along, and it's just Thursday.
So what do you think about this news that we just heard here on the newscast? Kirstie Alley out as the Pier 1 spokeswoman in one of the guys from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Well, if we follow the money, Celeste, here, the money is in feathering our nests. I think the fact that we've recognized the value of our nests, and I think it was the former governor of Texas said, "I support gay rights because if I didn't, who would cut my hair or decorate my home?"
Mm.
That was I thought a bit of a zinger.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Texas, you daydream of living on a ranch out west where you'd go to Walmart maybe every couple of weeks for groceries. That you say would be it for you and shopping, but then you say it'll never happen. How do you feel about shopping?
I think, speaking personally, I'm increasingly ambivalent to it in the sense that I could live the rest of my life on fruit, vegetables, pasta, wine, olive oil, yearly doses of socks and underwear, good reading and good listening. Everything else I have.
Yeah.
I run my own personal life, with the premise that I should own 40,000 possessions, and therefore if I bring something in the front door, I have to take something out the back door. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I've reached that stage in my life where my acquisition engine here doesn't need to work anymore.
Yeah. Do you think as we age we shop less?
Yes, certainly. One of the critical issues is that we are spending our money, but we're spending it on a broader assortment of stuff. We may be spending it on the education of our kids or our grandkids. We may be spending it on experiences that we're buying for ourselves. We also may, spend it on what I'd characterize as menopausal toys, particularly for men.
Hmm.
They buy Harleys and boats.
Interesting. Yeah, well, I find myself doing a whole lot less shopping, and I'm quite happy with that.
And to be discreet here, what generation are you a member of?
I'm at the tail end of the baby boom generation.
Okay. Well, it's a very logical time for you. On the other hand, there are many of us in the baby boomer generation who are sitting around our kitchen tables with our significant onlys talking about how we plan to live the last third of our lives. And for many of us, that involves some form of housing change or housing evaluation. And I think there's no irony that some of us are making the decision to move back into the urban core.
Mm-hmm.
The population bases of Chicago, New York, San Francisco, Seattle continue to go up as cities are repopulated with the rich, the young, and the childless. On the other end of the spectrum, if we look at the merchants that specialize in sort of the gentleman farm,
mm-hmm.
which are farm and fleet network, which I think is in your trade area. Don't you have Blaine's farm and fleet?
We do.
Okay. It's also the tractor supply store here, which is, you know, fueling all of those people, including me, who, you know, dream of a ranch somewhere. And our better judgment knows that we got no business there.
Yeah, well, it's great to go to the farm and fleet. You pick up the furnace filter. Maybe you pick up a flannel shirt because it's so chilly outside, and, gee, that feels really good. And then you go down and do a little daydreaming over the saddles, you know?
Or the barbed wire or the line dancing outfits there.
Yeah, very good.
It's a really unique corner in the American merchant lineup, because most of those farm and fleet stores are privately held.
Uh-huh.
And some of them are doing an enormous volume of business. And because they sit in a peculiar corner underneath that 125,000 square foot roof, you know, under those cold, cheap fluorescent mm-hmm. lights, are some of the most exotic cross sections of stuff that you'll find anywhere. There are suppliers who will sell things to the farm and fleet network that they won't sell to Walmart or Kmart or Target.
Really? Such as?
Some of it is the higher end fashion stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The Cathcart outerwear, mm-hmm. stuff like that. It's a really interesting retail experience.
Yeah.
And particularly since many of them, as is true in your markets, are sort of creeping into the edges of suburbia.
Right. Right. Well, also in Champaign-Urbana, Champaign is the retail powerhouse of the two communities.
Mm-hmm.
And Urbana has had some setbacks. It has one of the oldest malls in the country, which is struggling mightily. And with Kmart's downsizing, it lost the Kmart. So if you want to go shopping in Urbana, you might, for clothing or for a furnace filter, you have to go to the farm and fleet.
Well,
unless you want to go across town to Champaign. So.
Mazel tov,
yeah.
For farm and fleet on that side of the river.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about the call of the mall. Malls in other parts of the world. This was interesting. You've been in so many malls. Are the malls in other parts of the world similar to malls in the U.S.? Are they doing a better job? Are they doing the same job? Are they doing it worse than we do it?
Let's recognize that most malls in the U.S. are more than 20 years old, okay? And that many offshore malls are much more recent. If we look at the growth of malls across the globe here, I am guessing that we've had more malls built outside the U.S. in the past 5 years than have been, you know, built inside the U.S. And that many of those developers have come here, looked, watched, learned, and reinvented the mall in other places. Several things stick out. First is that many European and Asian malls have a very careful link to public transportation, that they're in some place that somebody can get to without driving a car.
Mm-hmm.
Second is those that have parking lots tend to manage those parking lots better, in the sense that many offshore malls have electronic systems to guide you to the nearest open parking place. Third is that many of them have conceived of the mall as a category killer destination, meaning that they want to take care of all of your needs in one place.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what that means is that they have successfully integrated the grocery store into the mall.
Mm-hmm.
They have integrated other services like a laundromat, which is particularly popular with singles. If you're a single working woman, wouldn't it be nice to be able to go to the mall and as you walk in the door, drop off your laundry, and an hour later it's washed, dried, and folded and ready for you to take home?
Mm-hmm.
And it means that it understands better the multitasking nature of what people's needs are and recognizes that by facilitating multitasking, in effect, they've built loyalty. They've built the ability to hold someone in a mall longer. I think it's smart.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because many of the malls built over the past 10 years have been built with some form of larger civic participation, that some of the malls have been actually interesting public buildings. Whether we're talking about the mall that Selfridges went into in Britain, which has won all the design awards, or we're talking about the Vasco da Gama Center outside of Lisbon, which looks like a huge ship, or we're talking about Blue Water, which the British put a mall into a abandoned quarry and in effect filled up a ecological blight with a shopping mall here. There are lots of interesting things with malls going on across the globe, and we see just a few examples of them happening here.
I like, the one thing I like about the mall is that there's so much within one big building. I know it's not pretty, but, it is, there is that convenience of it. But you know what, I have wondered, in the strip developments that we're seeing near malls, standalones or stand nears like Target, Home Depot, mm-hmm. Hobby Lobby, Old Navy, the chain restaurants, all that strip stuff that's around the mall. Why is that happening?
Some of it is because they are playing to your convenience engine here. That, Celeste, you walk into a mall and there are 150 stores, and how many of them do you actually go into?
Just a couple.
Okay. And what if they did a better job of just sort of centralizing that couple stores? Do you think you patronize that strip?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really what the logic is.
Yeah. But it's a lot more driving, too.
Well, it's also involves a calculated risk, too, which is if you drive into a regional shopping mall and you go shopping for a new dress, and you get to a store and there's a dress that you sort of like here, it's a lot easier to leave it behind and say, I'll see if I find something else I like better.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you pull into a strip mall and walk in the door at Labels for Less, you're much more likely to say, it's okay, I'll take it.
In the chapter of Call of the Mall, Dude, Where's My Car? You write about parking lots. Why are they so horrible?
That's a good question, Celeste. It's a good question. I keep having to remind my merchant clients that every parking lot has terrible weather in it 365 days a year. That nobody ambles across a parking lot.
Right. Well, there's no sidewalks.
Some of it is there are no sidewalks. I am not sure that if they put in sidewalks, people would use them. And we tend as an automobile culture to pull our car in and sort of, you know, take the most direct route to the door of our choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the challenges which we will have, particularly as our population base ages and our parking manners continue to disintegrate, is the basic issue of who has the right of way. That if I look at everything that's within 1,000 square feet or 100 of the front door, is it the pedestrian or the car that has right of way?
Mm-hmm. At the moment, it's the car.
There's another chapter in that book which I hope made you giggle, called Meanderthals.
Yes.
Which is just talking about the difference between urban and suburban walking customs here.
That was one of the chapters I enjoyed the most, where you tell us about walking at the mall and walking in the city.
Well, it's as an urban dweller, I often recognize the inexperienced suburban visitor here as they move down the sidewalk, sort of oblivious to what the traffic rules are.
Yeah, they're not equipped with what you call pedestrian radar.
Nobody's outfitted them.
Yeah. Well, the mall is such a different place from a city, an urban setting, an urban street scene.
Well, it's
so much more is going on, really.
So much. It's. I almost think that when people move into a city, that to register to vote here or to, you know, have their sale approved, that they have to take Walker's Ed.
Walker's Ed.
Walker's education, like driver's ed.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is just, here are the, you know, 25 rules that you need to be cognizant of so that, A, you're safe on the street, you don't get run over, and your neighbors start liking you.
Yeah. Now, have malls affected cities in terms of either walking or shopping culture?
Well, certainly the malls in their heydays in the 70s and 80s devastated America's downtowns.
Mm-hmm.
And, the opening of the regional shopping mall, just as the opening of Walmart created a raft of business failures, generally in the urban core, as the money all migrated out. I think that trend, while it isn't over, there is a certain stasis that has been reached. Retail follows housing, and as the housing market changes and people either move farther out or farther in, merchants are going to have to follow them. I find it very interesting to march down, whether it's Michigan Avenue in Chicago or Fifth Avenue here in New York City, and many of the stores now are basically chain stores that have come in from the shopping mall and are trying to make a go of it in an urban setting. Are there trade-offs here? Are there things that merchants are having to learn? Yes, and that's one of the things that we here at Envirocell are very actively involved with. That if you're a merchant that runs stores on an urban street, in a strip mall setting, and in a regional mall, what are the differences in terms of how a store looks, what the operating culture is, and what your responsibilities are to the customer walking in the door.
Mm-hmm. And that is very interesting as well, the what happens to you once you're inside the store. So are there retailers who are paying attention to that, and do they train their sales staffs differently depending on where they are?
I think you are seeing a merchant community that is recognizing that they have to do a better job of responding to tactical issues on a store-by-store basis. That if the 20th century was about, you know, merchant generals, whether it's, you know, Sam Walton or others that built these huge chains, that the 21st century is about empowering the captains and sergeants that run each store, and giving them the tools to respond creatively to the customer mixes that they themselves are serving.
Mm.
And an example of this, Celeste, which is one that I've used before, is if you're a drugstore chain and you have 30 drugstores in the Washington, D.C. market, in the District of Columbia, and those 30 stores serve, you know, for all practical purposes, 103% Afro-American customer bases, why are the stores stocking 600 items for blondes?
Mm-hmm.
Just as if I'm a bookstore, recognizing the difference between being located in El Paso, Laredo, Waco, and Dallas, all in the state of Texas, but with distinctly different customer mixes in each one of those locations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So inventory certainly is going to look different.
Well, one of the challenges here is to what degree can a store vary its offering based on that customer mix? And I think there are a couple of different store channels out there that are really challenged to meet that goal. One is the drugstore, which is increasingly everywhere. It's in a strip mall. We see drugstores in the regional shopping mall. And how can they respond to that issue? Second is apparel here, which is recognizing what is the ethnicity or what is the ethnic mix of people that I'm serving.
Mm-hmm.
Or it may be a consumer electronic store chain that recognizes that the Champaign-Urbana market, with the presence of a huge university, is, you know, different than suburban Illinois, where you're dealing with people in a completely different life stage and therefore a completely different relationship to the kind of products that they need. That if I'm Best Buy or Circuit City, outside of Chicago, I may very well be able to move home theater setups that cost tens of thousands of bucks, whereas in the Champaign-Urbana market, having a home sound system that links up my, you know, PC with my television with my something may be something that's much more relevant to a much more technically savvy market that actually has less money to spend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Paco Underhill. He's an urban geographer, a retail anthropologist, and an entrepreneur. He's the CEO and founder of EnviroCell. His latest book is Call of the Mall, Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we have a phone call coming in here, so we're going to go and talk with this listener who's calling us this afternoon from the state of Indiana on line four. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Two things I'd like to ask about. One, I'm sure it doesn't make any sense, but when you mentioned earlier about regional malls, first thing that shot in my mind was, well, if there's a regional, then there's a local, of course, then there's a, you know, higher. I was thinking of whether or not the small towns will eventually lose those malls because of competition, you know, among perhaps just two or three owners of all of them. And secondly, I was just wondering where you think malls are headed for areas that have, like, you know, 40, 50,000 population.
Okay. First one, we are definitely over-malled, that no one builds a mall today to serve a brand new market. They build a mall to steal somebody else's market. One of the interesting issues that we have as a consumer culture now is the fact that there are so many people competing for our business. Two things happen. First is that we're demanding both, you know, service and price. The second is our responsibility here if we don't get what we want to go spend our money somewhere else. The issue of what happens in small town America is an interesting one too. Some of it, I think the answer is a revitalization of downtown, or what is increasingly popular, which is a what they call a neo-urbanist mall, which has storefronts, has apartments over the stores, just like the old downtowns did, but presents itself as more a cross-section of services. Mm-hmm. Celeste, does that make sense?
It does make sense, and you know, I think we're seeing that in downtown Champaign, and my hope is that we would see it in downtown Urbana as well. And I think as we, you know, we began this conversation by talking about the changes that are ahead of us as we get older, and the thing about living, you know, downsizing your life a little bit, living well, but having things closer in and within walking distance and having that social connection. Do you know what I'm saying, Paco?
Yeah.
That social connection just right outside the door.
You know, Celeste, there is a new shopping mall that opened here in Manhattan in Columbus Circle in the past 6 weeks. And it is a high-rise mall. And the concept here is that a significant portion of the traffic shopping that mall is going to arrive by elevator.
Mm.
That the mall has a beautiful, fancy Whole Foods in the basement that is always crowded. What it is people who live over it, because you have a mall and then you have a high-rise condo complex over it and then an office tower. There are malls or there are condo buildings in that same area that are describing themselves as the only Miami retirement communities within walking distance of Lincoln Center. It's curious that the equity that an urban community has been positively affected by the clear progress that we've made as a culture in terms of dealing with crime and pollution.
Mm.
On the other, you know, side of it, you know, we have the whole new urbanist movement, which is trying to build better communities where, in effect, we have some connection with our neighbors. One of the problems, though, is finding a retail piece that works at that scale.
Right.
So that is there a new generation of, for example, general merchandise store that fits in to a community of, say, 300 houses?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it something that we reinvent the floating farmer's market?
Mm-hmm.
Or something, or arrive in a small community or a block, you know, on Saturday mornings at between 3 and 4 in the afternoon, and you have a chance to buy, you know, vegetables or
produce, yeah.
Produce here.
And arts and crafts.
Arts and crafts, and that, you know, it's a 3-hour window.
Mm-hmm. We have another listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with a caller in Urbana. Line 1, hi.
Hi, yes. I was. I had noticed that right after the holiday season this year, we had three pretty, very well-established mall chains, one of which went completely under. That was Fannie Mae. But a couple of others, too. KB Toys cut back hundreds of stores, including pretty much every one of them in central and southern Illinois. And then the B. Alton chain, which has been around since I've been a kid. I mean, it seems like, I don't know if all of them shut down, but apparently a lot of them shut down because they preferred, I guess they're owned by Barnes & Noble, and Barnes & Noble said we'd rather have these big box stores. So I'm wondering, is this due to the economy in general, or is this part of a larger trend affecting mall stores?
Okay, good question here. One of the things that malls have watched is the migration of certain categories of business away from the regional shopping mall. The first was sporting goods. You cannot buy a baseball mitt at a shopping mall anywhere. The second one that left was consumer electronics, with the exception of Radio Shack. It's tough to buy a stereo at a mall. The two other categories that are within the process of leaving the shopping mall now, one is music and the other is books. And there are a number of different reasons for it. First, the bookstore industry has found if they have a freestanding store, they, first of all, can stock a larger inventory. It is economical for them to offer a cafe where the margin on espresso is huge, and they can hold customers longer. The challenge that the bookstore industry has, I think, is looking at the mall bookstore and say, what is the purpose of this store? And this is something, having dealt with both Borders and Barnes and Noble, I know that both of them are looking at. And this is, what does it mean to have a bookstore that is basically set up for novice readers, as opposed to your, you know, acolyte or deacon category reader? What is it that makes a bookstore sell to a gift market, or position books as a gifting solution to it? Those are all really interesting issues. It also means that the pool of tenants that a mall has historically been able to attract is getting smaller. And just like the department store that historically shed, you know, categories of merchandise, the North American Mall is doing the same thing.
Mm. I had an unrelated question. One thing that I've noticed, and this isn't all mall stores, but certain chains, and the one I'm going to pick on here is Suncoast, which actually we don't have locally, but I've encountered this elsewhere. It's very hard now to just go up to the cashier and give them your money and walk away with a product, because you're peppered with questions about, you know, do you have our card, some kind of special, you know, purchase card, would you like 8 free issues of Entertainment Weekly and, you know, such. I mean, there's all sorts of free offers and things as you're trying to get out the door, which once, you know, irritates me because it just slows the process down, but it's also, I just wonder, is this is this going to be a trend, too, of just more and more of these kind of tie-ins with other companies?
I think we will see more of those here, and some of it is the recognition on the part of the merchant that they get a significantly higher piece of their business from a what is a reasonably narrow customer base. That if you're, the classic example here is at the high end. If you're a high-end department store, let's call it a Neiman Marcus in the Champaign Urbana market. Does there exist a Neiman Marcus there?
No.
Whoever is the high end, the customers that keep that store open at that high end are probably 250 women.
Wow.
Okay. There are 250 women that in Champaign Urbana that walk into that store and spend, let's say, $25,000 a year.
Wow.
Now, everyone else that walks in, they're happy to see them, but it's those 250 women that are critical to them. And one of the merchant challenges here is, how do I make sure that those 250 women feel special? As you were calling me this afternoon here, I was dealing with my bank, and I have a series of disputed charges on my charge card. And the fraud person on the other end was going, "I'm sorry, Mr. Underhill, you know, there are, you know, $600 in disputed charges here that we cannot honor because they were generated past the 60-day limit." And I'm turning to her and I say, "Do you know that I have my business accounts with you? I have three of your credit cards. I have ensured that there is a significant sum of money that's in your bank here. That my calculations is that I represent for you a profit margin for your bank that's in excess of $100,000 a year. Don't you think you should treat me a little differently about $600 in disputed charges?"
Yes, Mr. Underhill.
Yes, Mr. Underhill. I think it makes sense, but you know, in this case, did the fraud expert at Citibank say, "Yes, Mr. Underhill, I understand it, and I'll waive it in honor of, you know, 15 years worth of doing business with you"? No, her response was, "Why should I treat you differently than any other customer that we have?" And my response is, "I am a different customer."
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk with another listener, caller in line 2 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Oh, yes. As you noted, we have an old mall here in downtown Urbana that's struggling because everyone seems to go up to the newer mall and shopping centers up north. I was wondering if you had any suggestions on how to revitalize this mall. It's been a topic for quite some time, and I'd like to hear your input.
You know, there's a chapter in this book which I hope some of your listeners will go out and purchase, about the different examples of malls that have been repositioned. And I wish that all of them were sterling successes. The problem is that for every mall that has been significantly repositioned, there's another one out there that's basically asking for a timely date with Bulldozer and Mr. and Mrs. Dynamite. Mm-hmm. Where malls have worked here, first is repositioning malls with some ethnic base. Call it a Latino mall or a Korean mall. There are examples of this in Charlotte, in Atlanta, certainly in Southern California, where there is a big enough ethnic base to support somebody that's focused on a certain category of shopper. There are other malls that have been taken over by churches or faith-based groups that have turned them into community centers, senior housing, senior daycare. They've turned them into private schools. Again, there are more there are more malls out there to whom nobody knows what the hell
to do with them.
To do with them.
I think in Urbana, one of the things that they're trying is to make the mall more like the public square of old. So there are art shows. There's the, that's where the farmer's market is during the summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they've moved the farmer's market into the mall when the weather gets cold for mm-hmm. a period of time.
I think that's a great idea, Celeste.
Yeah, and they've also done something which I haven't seen. I haven't been there, but they're trying a weekend or a Sunday fun day. And I think it's with the park district, and they move all kinds of fun stuff in so families can come in and play on big balloons and slides and that kind of thing.
Some of it is making the transition from mall management being landlords to mall management being placemakers and event makers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in the farmers market movement that is going on across the U.S. because it's made a huge impact on the economic vitality of the small family farm. That as you have a small family farm that can grow exotic vegetables, take them directly to market in a farmer's market, and have a community that's willing to buy directly from the producer. There are small farms out there that weren't making any money 10 years ago that are doing just fine now.
Mm-hmm. Also, the farmer's market in Urbana is a wonderful place on Saturday morning to get together with people. And, you know, you're you can have a cup of coffee, and you're going to bump into people that you know, and you get to visit with them. And it seems like, you know, there's every demographic is there, which I think is interesting, too.
You know what I miss at my local farmer's mall or my local farmer's market is a cyber truck.
A cyber truck.
What I'm seeing here is that on Thursday night before the farmer's market on Saturday, I would go online and order a bunch of stuff, knowing that I'm going to the farmer's market. And once I've, you know, shopped, hung out, drunk coffee, you know, talked to the lady I've been buying vegetables from mm-hmm. for 10 years, I would go up to the cyber truck and say, my name is Underhill 47632-1. And they go, oh, Paco, nice to see you here. Here's all the, you know, toilet paper and whatever that you ordered online. And I'd never have to walk into another grocery store again.
Hmm. I like that idea. You know? You could do your shopping there, right there in one spot.
Well, it's recognizing that part of the challenge here is figuring out a delivery system that makes sense for us.
Oh.
And one of the challenges with the old, you know, cyber commerce world here is that it assumes that somebody is at home.
Hmm.
And I might point out that according to the 2002 census, only 28% of American households are formulated like Aussie insurance, where there's a mother, father, and dependent children living there.
Mm. Very interesting. Well, we have a whole bank full of callers. Unfortunately, we can't take them now because we've used up all the time. That's unfortunate. Maybe you'd come back on the program and be with us again.
Celeste, I'm always happy to hang out with you online.
Okay, take care. Paco Underhill has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Call of the Mall. He is also the author of Why We Buy, The Science of Shopping, that book now available in paperback. Call of the Mall, his latest, is published by Simon and Schuster. Paco Underhill spends a lot of time shopping. Well, I don't know if shopping per se, but he spends a lot of time watching how we shop. He is a pioneer in consumer behavior. He's the founder and CEO of EnviroCell Incorporated. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade, another wild one for the day. Boy, the trader's going to be just worn out by the time we get to Friday of this week. She's just bounced around all over the place in the bean pit. Check this out. Another 20-cent move up this week for the beans for the day. So that's a 30-cent move on one day, and I think an 18-cent drop yesterday, 20 cents up in the beans. But we'll get to those numbers here in just a minute. Corn futures for the day up a penny and a quarter, so they had a much calmer day. But the wheat contracts were lower, down about 4 cents across that floor. The March futures are 361, high, a low at 355. A settlement price there at 355. They were down 4. May futures 368 and a half, high, low at 360 and 3 quarters. The settlement price at 361 and a quarter, down 4 3/4. In July wheat from the Board of Trade in Chicago, 372 the high, low at 364 and a quarter. A settlement price for that harvest month, July at 364 and a half, down 4 1/2 cents for the day. September futures in the wheat pit, 376 and a half high, low at 369. Settlement price on that low at 369, down 4 cents. In December wheat, 384 and 3/4 for the high, the low at 378. A settlement price at 378 and 3/4, down 4 1/4. Now the March corn, 295 and a half on the high, the low at 291 1/3. March corn settled 293, a penny and a quarter higher for the day. May futures 302 and 3/4 high, low at 298. A settlement price 299 up 3/4. In July corn, a 306 and a quarter high, low at 301 and a half. A settlement price at 302 and a half, and they finished a half higher. September futures up a half as well, 298 and a half the high, the low at 294 3/4. A settlement price at 295 and a quarter. Once again, that September up a half cent. December futures, this year harvest month, 295 and a half high, low at 291 1/4, settled 292 1/4, up a half cent. In the March futures, 296 the high, the low at 292. Settlement price at 292 3/4, up 3/4 cent. July corn, 298 the high, the low at 294 1/2. A settlement price at 295 1/4 for the July corn, up 1 1/4. In December 05 corn contract, 267 1/2 high, low at 266. Settled on that low at 266. They finished the day unchanged. March oats, 158 the high, the low at 155 3/4. A settlement at 157, up 1 3/4. And May oat contract, a 162 high, low at 158 1/4, settled 160. They finished 2 higher as well. From the soy complex, this is where most of the action happened all day long. It made the corn pit look really quite calm all day long, even though they had a little bit of a 4-cent trading range there. The March beans, a 944 on the high for the day. Let's take this back. March beans looked like this for the day. A high of 947, a low at 928, a settlement price at 944, and they were up 20 1/2 cents. May futures, 951 and a half the high, the low at 930. Settlement price about halfway between that at 944, a little better than half, in fact, 20 and a half higher there. July soybeans, 938 and a half the high, the low at 922. Settlement price at 933 and 3/4, up 18 and 3/4. In the Septembers, 818 and a half on the high, the low at 812. Settlement price, 814. They finished 8 higher. November beans, 743 the high, the low at 734. Settled 739, up 7 1/4 in the January contract. A 740 high, low at 735, settlement price just a penny above that at 736, 5 higher for the day. And the March beans of 05, 735 the high, the low at 730, settlement price 734, they finished 8 cents higher. The March bean meal now 286 on the high, the low at 280.30, settled 285.50, up 670 for the day. The May contract 287 for the high, the low at 282.50, a settlement price at 286.60, up 590. And the March bean oil 33.54 for the high, the low at 32.95, settled 33.30, up 80. May bean oil, 33.38, the high, the low at 32.55, a settlement price, 33.19. They finished up 79 for the day. Now here's the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange with Celeste Quinn. Was that to say that we weren't on the air potentially?
That's right, Todd, although we are on the internet, but yes, we are off the air.
I got you. Well, I'll have to remember that as we go into the closing market report.
So as we are on the internet, I will give the prices from the Mercantile Exchange.
All righty.
Here. March feeder cattle, 89.45 the high. Excuse me, that was the settlement. March feeder cattle, the high 89.45, the low 88.95, the settlement 89.45, that up 22 1/2. April, today's high 88.05, the low 87.30, the settlement 87.97 1/2, that up 7 1/2. May, Today's high 87.15, the low 86.35. The settlement 87.12.5, that up 17.5. March live cattle, let's skip that one. April live cattle, today's high 82.45, the low 81.65. The settlement 81.82.5, that down 60. June live cattle, today's high 76.55, the low 75.67.5, the settlement 76.45, that up 7.5. August live cattle, the high today 75.15, the low 74.97.5, excuse me, that's incorrect. August live cattle, the high 75.15, the low 74.05, the settlement 74.97.5, that up 22.5. April lean hogs, the high today 64 even, the low 63.35, the settlement 63.72.5, that up 107.5. May, the high today 64.10, the low 63.40, the settlement 64.02.5, that up 72.5. June lean hogs, today's high 70 even, the low 68.82.5, the settlement 69.90, that up 90. July lean hogs 66.05, the settlement today. Today's high was 66.10, the low 64.95. Again, the settlement 66.05, that up 115. March pork bellies, today's high 98.47.5, the low 97.05, the settlement 98.32.5, that up 142.5. May pork bellies, today's high 98.65, the low 97.60, the settlement 98.35, that up 102.5.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Myrene Hildebrand from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan writes, Dear Dr. Science, is there any scientific way I could test a person for suitability as a potential mate? I'd like to stop making the same mistakes, and if there's a scientific way of increasing my odds at success, I'd like to employ it.
Litmus paper works better than almost anything besides gas chromatography, and it's non-destructive of the sample. Pick up a pack of litmus paper at any scientific supply house. I always carry a few strips in my pocket protector, just in case I need to check someone out. You can conceal the strip in your hand and clap the unknown quantity on the back or rub the area behind the ear. If the strip indicates a pH of less than 7, that means the person's acidic in nature. Watch out! One of my ex-wives measures 1.4. On the other hand, a pH of 14 indicates a base fellow, well-grounded, not too highfalutin to get his hands dirty, devoted, stable, boring.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Visit Dr. Science on the web at www.drscience.com.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcast.